Well, good evening and welcome. And those of you who are Giants fans and are on the call instead, congratulations. We've pulled Dr. Miller away from that as well. But I do want to introduce you to Dr. Alec Miller, who will be our speaker tonight. Just personally, I'll say, Alec, thank you so much for doing this. For those of you who are familiar with him, you know how lucky we are to have him on the call tonight. And those of you who are not, this is probably the premier person in the country working with adolescents and DBT, so we're very fortunate to have Alec with us tonight. Those of you who did not get handouts, you are correct. We don't have handouts tonight, so don't worry that you missed something. If you'd like to send any questions, send it to neabpd@aol.com. And those of you also who would like to help support these calls and continue making them available on our website, we greatly appreciate donations, so we hope that you'll think of giving us a donation. Also, lastly, before Alec starts his presentation, I do want to remind or maybe inform most of you that we have a conference with Alec Miller and Blaise Aguirre from McLean Hospital on Friday, March 9th at the Crown Plaza in White Plains. If those of you want more information, can go on our website at borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. You can also register there. Seats are filling up, and I'm sure at the end it's going to will be closed out before the conference. So if you're interested in this topic, and in particular hearing both from Dr. Miller and Dr. Aguirre, please do sign up sooner than later. So it's now my pleasure to turn the hour over to Alec Miller, and again, welcome, Alec, and thank you so much for donating your time to this conference call.
Well, thank you, Perry, and I want to thank NEABPD for the invitation, and if it weren't for the incredible mission that you and your organization have, I probably would be still in front of the Giants football game, so I am very pleased to be here with you. So as many of you know, the topic this evening is adolescent borderline personality disorder, diagnosis, and treatment. And what I'm hoping to cover in the 45 or 50 minutes of my lecture time before we get into Q&A is starting out a little bit with the diagnostic issues, the research updates, and the remaining debates in the field about this diagnosis. And then I'd like to talk about the behaviors often associated with BPD, including some issues around suicide, non-suicidal self-injury, and the multi-diagnostic profile that we often see. And then I want to move into what are the treatments for borderline personality disorder and why DBT specifically for adolescents. And I'd like to turn my attention for the latter portion of my talk tonight on the biosocial theory and how important it is for us to understand this theory for family members, for practitioners, and why this is so relevant in terms of the etiology and the maintenance of BPD, and then a little bit about the different treatment modes in DBT as well. So let me get started. I think, you know, one of the questions that often comes up at most workshops and conferences I go to is it permissible to diagnose an adolescent with a personality disorder, and in particular BPD? And you know, a lot of practitioners who come to these workshops are asking that question. I wish that was even a question for many of the practitioners in the community who don't necessarily show up to these workshops. For many child practitioners who work with children and adolescents, the concept of a personality disorder rarely enters their mind, I think, when they're... And so part of the problem is that graduate schools these days are not teaching practitioners who work with youth personality disorders. So it's not even part of their training in graduate school to date. And as an aside, much to my dismay, most graduate schools don't teach about suicide assessment and crisis intervention either. So for those of us who work with youth with personality disorders and suicidality, it's still an uphill battle to get the graduate schools to consider the value of training and assessment and intervention in these domains. But one more aside while I'm at it is 10 years ago, the NIMH rejected my ideas to study suicidal teens with borderline personality disorder, arguing that I had to focus on mood disorders as the inclusion criteria and that BPD or borderline features couldn't be the inclusion criteria in the research study. So it's an uphill battle even at the federal level to help the government officials appreciate the value of assessment and intervention of personality disorders in youth. So Perry Hoffman and NEABPD have done a marvelous job trying to ring the alarm bells, as has John Gunderson, drawing some attention to the importance of this. A lot of folks, I think, are happy to stick with G. Stanley Hall, who about a century ago, in 1904, developed the storm and stress theory of adolescence. And, you know, the idea that a lot of teenagers are going to hit some bumps in the road, there'll be some potholes along the way. However, many of the teenagers will drive through their adolescence without any major major stuck points. But I think there are others who have definitely discovered over the last 15 years that there are plenty of teenagers who have more pervasive and severe symptomatology that may result in chronic personality disorders beginning clearly in adolescence. And there's a slew of research, if you look over the last 20 years, of community research and clinical research that finds the presence of PD, personality disorders, in people before the age of 18. There are a lot of reasons why, in addition to the lack of training, why I think people don't want to diagnose personality disorders in adolescence. One of it is, as I said, is sheer ignorance, but unfortunately some of it is stigma, and I think there's a fear that if you apply such a diagnosis to a youth, that that adolescent will be blackballed, if you will, in the treatment community because of the unfortunate stigma that has historically been associated with personality disorders. I think that stigma is dissipating, and I've always said that if you actually characterize this disorder descriptively, without interpretation, that is, that teenagers who have BPD have a primary problem of regulating emotions, and from that they have trouble regulating their behaviors and their relationships are affected and so forth, and just describe it without interpretation and judgment, I think people are not feeling the stigma associated with it, and especially Mary Zanarini's work, which shows longitudinally that people do age out of it, especially over time, that it's not a lifelong sentence. So one thing is we as a field need to do better by describing it as it is, and I think the stigma might actually dissipate. And the other thing is I think for many folks who work in community mental health and who are reliant on insurance companies to pay for their services, there's been a reimbursement issue for people diagnosed with personality disorders, and the insurance companies have basically made it so that you'd have to find an Axis I disorder, or, you know, a mood disorder, anxiety disorder, substance use disorder, as the primary diagnosis in order for there to be reimbursement, and that personality disorders were rarely reimbursable by insurance companies over the years. So there are several reasons why I think it's difficult for practitioners to apply this diagnosis. Now, another interesting thing that most people are surprised by is that if you look at the DSM-4, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, that is the mental health practitioner's Bible, so to speak, it clearly states that you may, in fact, apply a diagnosis of a personality disorder to someone under the age of 18 if there's a pervasive and persistent pattern of problematic behavior, you know, that meets the diagnostic criteria, that is, that's unrelated to an episode of an Axis I disorder. So people often say, no, the DSM says you cannot do that, and I refer them, you know, to the page 631 and says, no, you can clearly may apply that diagnosis if you look carefully. Now, a lot of the, you know, jokingly, a lot of people say, well, isn't adolescence a personality disorder? And if we all reflect on our own adolescence, at any given, on a given day, I might have met full criteria for BPD, and I think many people on this call may have. The question is that, you know, in terms of meeting diagnostic criteria, there has to be some temporal stability. And that is that, you know, if if I'm going to look this way 2 weeks from now, 6 months from now, a year from now, will I show these same characteristics? And so when I looked at the literature to see, look at the temporal stability of the diagnosis, I'll highlight just a few studies that have found a subgroup of adolescents who at time one meet diagnostic criteria for BPD, and then 2 years later also meet criteria. So Garnett and colleagues did a study in 1994 of inpatient adolescents diagnosed with BPD, and they found that 2 years later, one-third of that sample still retained the diagnosis. Okay, that's one study. So that's a third. And David Bernstein in 93 did a large community study. So this is not a clinical sample. And he found of those who met criteria, 24% of the adolescents who actually met criteria time one still met criteria 2 years later. And then Andrew Channon in 2004 found three-quarters of the older adolescent outpatients who met criteria for personality disorder retained the diagnosis 2 years later. So 33%, 24%, 74%. There's clearly a large subgroup of individuals, adolescents, who at time one meet criteria and still retain it 2 years later. Exactly who are the kids who will hold on to that diagnosis and those who will not is still not 100% clear. They're just beginning to do some research to try to tease out what are the diagnostic features of those teens who will seem to be more likely to retain the diagnosis. But that's still a work in progress. But I think one of the most interesting studies that I've come across in the last few years about this diagnostic issue and the functional impairment associated with it, there was a study done in 2008 by Greta Winograd at New York Psychiatric Institute, and she did a very unusual 20-year prospective study. That is, she followed a large cohort of adolescents and then followed, looked at them 20 years later. And that's, if we had a nickel for I wish we had more of these studies because it's such an impressive feat. So she followed 600 adolescents and followed them into the 30s. And the question was, what impairment would these kids have? Now, any of us who work in the field and any of us who have children or family members with a diagnosis of BPD can imagine that there would be significant adverse outcomes for those who have higher borderline symptoms in their adolescence. And lo and behold, the outcomes of the study was exactly that, that those in their teens who had higher borderline symptoms had major impairment in relational, academic, functioning, well, occupational functioning that went into their 30s. I have some parents and families who come into my office who say, come on, Dr. Miller, aren't some of these kids, isn't my child just going through some bumps in the road, as G. Stanley Hall suggests, and do we really have to do this intensive treatment? Why do you suggest we have to do that? And, you know, for years my clinical anecdotal data suggested that, but there's now a 20-year prospective study by Winograd that says we have to take this seriously and we can't poo-poo the fact that these borderline symptoms are significant, and while we can't guarantee that this individual's adolescent will end up with significant life impairment in their 30s without treatment, there are some research data to suggest we should be concerned about that, and therefore we should treat it as thoroughly as possible. Now, another interesting thought I have about this, and a lot of my colleagues have as well, is this arbitrary cutoff about, you know, this 18th birthday, and that people believe it's really not fair to give a diagnosis to someone before they're a full-fledged adult. But I really see this as an arbitrary cutoff, and certainly plenty of parents and practitioners who are familiar with personality disorders report on their 9-year-olds or their 12-year-olds, and they're clearly exhibiting behaviors associated with BPD well before this child's 18th birthday. So many of us feel strongly about this avoidance of applying the diagnosis. And my feeling is if the shoe fits, as I suggested earlier, we should apply it because otherwise we're doing a disservice to the adolescent. I wrote a review article in 2008 with two of my colleagues, Jennifer Mellencamp and Colleen McLean Jacobson, discussing this issue. And I know John Gunderson also wrote an article in 2009 in the American Journal of Psychiatry, in which he argues that people should not avoid applying the diagnosis to individuals under the ages of 18, because if we keep doing this, A, as I said, we're not only perpetuating the stigma, this is too awful a diagnosis, but we're also going to be ending up misapplying diagnoses. So we might give the wrong diagnosis, for example, bipolar disorder when it's not, or we might give an insufficient diagnostic picture. That is, that this individual adolescent may have BPD and also a mood disorder and also a substance use disorder, but that it's a complex profile that needs to be highlighted with the personality disorder too. And furthermore, research states that treating Axis 1 disorders, for example, major depression, without targeting borderline personality disorder results in poor outcomes. And Markowitz and others at Cornell published some studies suggesting that. So, again, arguing, A, we need to assess, and B, we need to treat the personality disorder and not just rely on treating Axis 1. One of my colleagues, Jill Rathis, who I co-authored our adolescent DBT book with, one of her students, Matthew Brightman, just defended his dissertation recently at CW Post, and I was on his dissertation committee, partly because he collected the data from my clinic in the Bronx at Montefiore. And he found that those youth who met only 3 out of 9 or 4 out of 9 diagnostic criteria were much more similar to those who met full criteria. And for those of you familiar with that, that's at least 5 out of 9 diagnostic criteria. And they were similar more in terms of the frequency and intensity of suicidal and self-injurious behaviors, as well as the coexistence of mood disorders. So my take-home message here is, we need to really assess for the features of the diagnosis. Not just is it present or absent, but are there features? And because even having 3 out of 9 diagnostic criteria may reflect significant distress and dysfunction, and we should treat it prophylactically. Now, I really do believe that we have to treat the signs and symptoms early to help prevent the full disorder from blossoming and becoming more refractory. As Perry mentioned in the introduction, we're going to have this wonderful adolescent BPD conference on March 9th, and Mary Zanarini from Harvard Medical School is going to present some of her current research on the diagnostic issues of adolescent BPD. But just some of the literature review article I did in 2008 found that the prevalence and the reliability and the validity of BPD in adolescent samples are adequate and largely comparable to those found in adult samples. So what I'm saying is it really does appear that BPD operates in a similar fashion and has a similar course regardless of age and developmental period. And as I said, there are a subgroup for whom the diagnosis is stable over time, and there are some for whom they move in and out of the diagnostic criteria. Okay, so I there's plenty more to talk about on this diagnostic issue and debate, and I'm happy to answer more questions about that during the Q&A, but I want to move on to other elements of tonight's talk. And so I want to highlight some other associated features of those with BPD, namely that many of the folks that we treat are multi-problem teenagers. And what I know about suicide risk is that it increases exponentially as an adolescent accrues additional problems. So when there's substance use issues, when there's disordered eating behaviors, there's increased risk for suicidality. Now, I wanted to kind of let this audience know tonight, if we look at just the general adolescent population, about 1 out of every 5 high school students has seriously considered suicide in the past year. And 15% of those have made a specific plan, and about 9% have actually attempted suicide. So that's about a million teenagers, of whom 700,000 have required medical attention for their suicidal behavior. And the research suggests that up to about 10% of the teen suicide attempters may eventually die from suicide. So it's serious. We have to take these behaviors very seriously. One of my greatest concerns when I first got into the field and started studying this population in the early to mid-90s was that some research found that up to three-quarters of those adolescent suicide attempters who showed up in emergency rooms failed to attend or complete treatment. So they'd show up after a suicide attempt in the emergency room, and only about one-quarter of the kids would go on for any outpatient or inpatient treatment. And so the question was raised, what is the matter with our field that we are unable to engage and retain suicide attempters in outpatient treatment? And that is one of the main studies that got my attention to look at DBT as a possible treatment, because DBT seemed to be targeting a lot of the therapy interfering behaviors that some of the clients would engage in terms of, so we would be carefully attending to and treating anything that got in the way of their following through with their treatment. And so we'll talk more about that. Then there's the issue of non-suicidal self-injurious behavior. And Kim Grant has done a lot of research in this area, and her definition of this is the deliberate or direct destruction or alteration of body tissue without conscious suicidal intent, but resulting in injury severe enough for tissue damage to occur. And some of the community studies, again, with adolescents, have found that just, quote-unquote, normal teenagers, 14 to 18% have engaged in non-suicidal self-injury in the past year. So that's a large number of kids who are self-harming without suicidal intent. Now, when we look at clinical samples, that number doubles and triples. Now we're talking 20 to 60% of youth in clinical samples have engaged in non-suicidal self-injury. The typical age of onset for teenagers is between 12 and 14 years of age. And historically, this has been associated with a female behavior, if you will, that more girls and more women would engage in self-harm was the kind of the myth. But looking at large epidemiological studies, there's not consistent evidence, especially among adolescents, that it's more girls than boys. In fact, plenty of boys do it. They're just not necessarily showing up for treatment if you look at epidemiological research. And same thing ethnically and socioeconomically. There's no consistent evidence to suggest that there's differences between subgroups. In terms of just common methods, just while I'm at it, just to make sure everyone's aware to assess for this. And again, this is one of those things that if you don't assess at when an adolescent comes into the office, they aren't necessarily going to reveal it. And even if they say, yes, you know, they came in after, let's say, an inpatient admission, and there may be an incident of self-cutting, for example, using a razor blade or some other implement, you should also ask about the myriad of other ways of self-injury, including burning and scratching and hair pulling and reopening up scabs and wounds and biting and ingesting poisons. Or I had a patient who ingested Clorox bleach, not with intent to die, but intent to harm her esophagus, or banging herself into objects and so forth. So I really want to advise people that when you're doing an intake, that you do a comprehensive assessment of the myriad ways of self-injury, because they, again, they aren't necessarily revealed unless asked. So the question is, you know, why do teenagers engage in such high frequency of these behaviors? Because I argue that non-suicidal self-injury is one of the most common is an epidemic, I think, of the 21st century, and I think is a very common coping strategy for our youth these days, and especially common among adolescents with BPD. And there's a lot of theoretical reasons for this, and depending on your theoretical orientation, you can argue different reasons. But from an empirical standpoint, Mitch Prinstein and others have done some research, and at least what we can get at from Conscious Report is that most adolescents say the main reason they engage in non-suicidal self-injury is to regulate their emotions. Many of them say it helps to suppress negative emotions, and so if they are having urges to self-harm, and after if they have a fight with their boyfriend, let's say, and they feel sad or hurt or angry, the self-injury functions to relieve them temporarily of that negative affect. It lessens their emotional pain, which unfortunately gives them relief. And when you get relief, that it's the principle of learning principle of negative reinforcement. Whereas you feel some discomfort, you engage in a behavior, that behavior yields relief, you're more likely to do that again. When you get in your car to drive to the office or drive anywhere, and you hear that the bell ringing in your car when you start your engine, that's an annoying sound. The way you get relief from that annoying sound, the car makers figured out, is to put on your seatbelt. So you're more likely to engage in putting on your seatbelt behavior. So the challenge, of course, is that for many of our teenagers, they feel relief, and it works. And so we need to help them recognize there may be alternative methods to achieving emotional relief without having to resort to self-injury. There are some youth who feel emotion regulation when they feel so numb inside, they self-harm and they feel an increase in affect, which then kind of helps them to feel more grounded and less dissociated. And for them, it kind of serves this function of positive reinforcement, right, which they're more likely to do that again, given the consequence of feeling more positive that way. So, nevertheless, there's learning that happens somewhat out of their awareness, but it sustains that behavior and it gets reinforced. Now, suicidal and non-suicidal self-injury are two of a cluster of other high-risk behaviors associated with BPD. Many of the teens I work with have engaging in school refusal and behavior, risky sexual behaviors. Some engaging in substance use and abuse. Some are engaging in disordered eating behaviors. Some in violent behaviors. And the question is, I think many of the teenagers I work with, many of the borderline personality disorder problem behaviors are solved, in the quote-unquote solved, when you think about an escape and avoidance paradigm. So what I mean by that is, if we take a 15-year-old girl, for example, who has been told by her boyfriend that the relationship is over, that he doesn't care about her anymore and wants to pursue another relationship. What that tends to do is it triggers often an intolerable, aversive emotional state. And like I said, it could be sadness, it could be anxiety, loneliness. But what happens here for many of our adolescents who have BPD is they can't tolerate these emotions, and they tend to engage in escape and avoidance behaviors. Now, what are those behaviors? Those are suicidal ideation or non-suicidal self-injury, or leaving class, or binging and purging, or using alcohol or drugs. And the point I'm making here from our case conceptualization is that for many of our youth, from a behavioral perspective, when they engage in these problematic, or I'll call target behaviors, it often provides some relief. They get temporary relief, and like I said, this idea of negative reinforcement. So it's reinforced. They feel emotional pain. They escape from it by engaging in problematic behaviors. They get relief. They're more likely to do it again. So this whole cycle, I often draw on a dry erase board for the teen and even the family members to understand how this cycle works. And what this tells us from a treatment perspective is that we need to help our teenagers learn how to experience and tolerate negative affects with greater skill. And when they have trouble tolerating those emotions in the future, I want to provide them with sufficient distress tolerance skills so that they don't need to self-harm or engage in disordered eating behaviors to cope, but rather some other, in DBT language, distraction or self-soothe skills that can serve some temporary relief, and that can be reinforcing too. So what are the treatments for BPD in adults? Well, most of you on this phone call, I'm sure, are quite familiar with the range of them, and I'll just mention them for those of you who are not. The evidence-based psychotherapies are transference-focused psychotherapy, Kernberg and Clarkin and others, schema-focused psychotherapy by Jeff Young, mentalization-based therapies by Bateman and Fonagy, and DBT by Marshall Linehan. There's certainly plenty of polypharmacy that's used with adult patients with BPD, and I would argue with plenty of adolescent patients with BPD as well. But interestingly, even though there are evidence-based treatments that I just mentioned, most practitioners in the community do supportive and eclectic therapies, or what we might call treatment as usual, which is a range of supportive, eclectic, some polypharmacy, but not necessarily following a evidence-based practice, as mentioned above. So the question becomes, why learn a new treatment? If you're in the community and trying to work with this population, why bother learning a new treatment? And then I would argue, why not DBT? So the answer, I guess, is first of all, you know, maybe I don't know any treatment for this population, so I need to learn a treatment for those of you who are unfamiliar. Some might say, well, the old one doesn't work, so I need to learn a new treatment. Another answer might be the new one has better treatment outcomes, so I want to do that. Or the new one has the same treatment outcomes, but is more efficient and is preferred by providers and is more humane. And I guess I chose DBT years ago, first of all, because of the overwhelmingly positive outcomes based on multiple randomized controlled trials. And as a clinical psychologist who values empirical research, I really felt strongly about doing treatments that had evidence to support them. And frankly, and I'll say this to anybody, including Marsha Linehan, I think she'll say the same, I'm going to switch treatment approaches if something better comes along. So even though I've been doing DBT for 17 years or so, I'm happy to move on to something else if something has better outcomes and is more efficient, more preferred by providers, more humane. So I'm happy to switch if the data suggests that. But in the meantime, I'm feeling comfortable with my DBT approach. Now, the biosocial theory, which I'm going to go into more depth in a few minutes, guides the therapy, and it suggests that there's this transaction between a biological and environmental factors that helps me to better understand the etiology and the maintenance of BPD. And if I understand how this adolescent client of mine developed BPD and why it's maintained, I'm much more able to have compassion for my client and for their family, and I think helps me and them, the families, better understand the disorder. So it gives me some real treatment parameters and treatment targets that the biosocial theory helps inform them. Also, I like DBT partly because it's so skills-based, and the teenagers and the parents alike, I think, recognize the notion of skills deficits. And it's much easier to say, you know, if somebody only has one leg at birth, it's very hard to expect them to go running without major help and habilitation and some form of training to teach them how to walk that way. And so we do a lot of skills training to help them deal with the whatever deficits they have. And the other point I want to make about why DBT, and I'll go into more depth in a moment, is that I think the multimodal nature of this treatment helps us enter the adolescent's lives, you know, through these different modalities. So you have a chance to work one-on-one with the teenager. There's an opportunity to work with the teen and the family in a multi-family skills training group. There's opportunities to work with the family and do some in vivo work with them there. And then I have access to the teenager between sessions by phone to do some phone coaching. And as someone who's a teacher of various things, including therapy and music and so on, I find it very advantageous to not only teach my student or client skills in a skills training group, but to be able to coach them in real time when they're having real difficulty, you know, outside of the therapy office. And I love the notion of being called or paged at that moment and say, okay, what skills have you tried? Can we try this? Let's get you through this crisis right now without making the situation worse. So that's a big appeal in my mind to this treatment. So many of you are probably familiar with that DBT research in terms of randomized trials has been shown to be superior to most comparison treatments in reducing suicidal behavior and premature treatment dropout and so forth. And I'm not going to review all the adult treatment data, but I want to just spend a few minutes just talking about the adolescent research. And about 10 years ago, Jill Rathis and I published an article in 2002 on a 12-week outpatient trial in which we looked at suicidal and borderline teenagers, and I'll mention those outcomes to you in a moment. And there's a few other researchers. Fleischacher et al. Did some research in Germany in 2006 using our model, but he did a 16-week outpatient treatment for suicidal adolescents with borderline features, and then 4 or 5 years later, he did another study with a one-year follow-up. So there's several studies now that are not randomized, but have promising outcomes. And there's a whole range of studies where DBT has been adapted to other populations, but that obviously is not the thrust of today's talk. So I'll highlight briefly Jill Rathis' study that I did with her about 10 years ago, where we had about 111 teens, and we looked pre and post at a 12-week outpatient treatment in the Bronx of mostly females and age range 12 to 18 and a mostly ethnic minority population. And we included kids who had made a suicide attempt in the last 4 months or had current suicidal ideation, but also met criteria for BPD or borderline features, three features at least on the SCID2. And before treatment, the DBT group had more severe issues. In other words, they had more Axis 1 disorders. The DBT group was more depressed. There were more borderline personality disorder characteristics. The DBT group had more prior hospitalizations, and they were actually about a year older. I don't know if I said that there's 29 DBT kids and 82 in the treatment as usual condition. And just the summary of this study, very briefly, was that at week 12, there was about 13% of the kids in treatment as usual had to be hospitalized versus none of the kids in DBT. And we did significantly better in terms of retaining our kids as well in DBT, and that is 62% of the adolescents in DBT completed versus 40% of the treatment as usual group. And while there was no statistically significant differences in suicide attempts in those 12 weeks, it's a very low base rate behavior. 9% of the TAU kids made a suicide attempt during 12 weeks versus the 3% of the DBT kids. But what I think is also interesting is that even in 12 weeks, according to our the Life Problems Inventory, that is a self-report of borderline personality symptomatology, there were significant reductions on all four domains of borderline symptomatology from according to the DBT kids in terms of reductions of emotional dysregulation, reductions in impulsivity, reductions in interpersonal problems, and reductions in this confusion about self. Now, this was a not a funded study, so we didn't have funds to track our clients down and get follow-up data. But this was a good preliminary study that kind of led the way for further research. My colleague Tina Goldstein in Pittsburgh, by the way, did an interesting study doing DBT with teens who had bipolar disorder, but some of whom had BPD or borderline features. And what I found interesting as we all know, there's definitely some interesting overlap between borderline and bipolar in terms of emotional dysregulation, impulsivity. Her pilot study of only 10 found that it was a very highly acceptable treatment, that over 90% of the scheduled sessions were attended by teens and parents, and that at the end of this, their treatment study, there were significant improvements in reductions in emotional dysregulation and in suicidality, non-suicidal self-injury, hospitalizations, and depressive symptoms. And Tina published her research in a very prestigious journal called the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry in 2007. And she's now underway in a randomized trial for bipolar adolescents with who are suicidal. But I wanted to tell you, I'm very excited to report that my colleague Lars Mellum in Norway is nearly done with a five-year study. I was training him and his team in Norway to train them in DBT, and they have a 16-week study of DBT versus enhanced treatment as usual of suicidal teenagers with borderline features. And this is at the University of Oslo. And what he has found is that in the 16-week trial, compared to enhanced care as usual, that they, first of all, they had a very low dropout rate. So about 85% of the patients have completed. Now, he's only looked at, by the way, he's only looked at the intermediate analysis. So even though he's hoping to get 80 subjects, this analysis I'm telling you about now is only based on the first 40. But they have a low dropout rate. He found it to be very well received by teens and parents alike in Oslo, and that 80% of the treatment completers stopped self-harm, and there were significant differences in DBT versus enhanced care as usual, and that the DBT group had significantly better reductions in self-harm and suicidal ideation, and that these changes occurred early in the treatment period. So this is a 16-week trial, and so, again, this is a very interesting finding, and this when it's done, will be the first randomized controlled trial of adolescent DBT. So the jury's still out. We have to wait for the final analyses, but the interim analyses look very promising. And the only other study that's a randomized trial of adolescents, suicidal adolescents with BPD, is Emily Cooney's study in New Zealand, and she's hopefully going to be publishing some of those results shortly, and we're eagerly awaiting those, and I don't know what those outcome are yet. And I guess Marsha Linehan and Michelle Burke and Joan Osternow at UCLA are doing a study looking at suicidal adolescents, and I'm not clear whether they have to have borderline features or not, but they're doing a study that's just getting underway as we speak. So let me see what I also want to highlight for you here. I think one of the things I was saying that I'd like to talk about for a few minutes before we break off into Q&A is a little bit about the biosocial theory, that Marsha Linehan developed this theory to help therapists engender greater compassion for her adult clients with BPD. But as you learn the theory, I think it treats not only the therapist, it helps us as therapists, but it helps treat the family, it helps treat school personnel, it helps treat medical personnel, including pediatricians and medical specialists working with kids who have BPD and medical conditions. It really changes our attitudes towards our client, towards our family member, towards our student. Because if you understand that BPD is a pervasive disorder of the emotion regulation system, and that means that there is this biological dysfunction, right? There's a neurobiological basis for a lot of the behavior that we see. And you take someone who has this biological predisposition and reaction to response to emotions where they're more sensitive, they're more reactive to emotions, they have a slower return to their emotional baseline, and you place this vulnerable individual in what we call an invalidating environment. The transaction between the biology and the environment over time seems to yield pervasive emotional dysregulation, which is the foundation for BPD. Now, the problem with many of our teens who have BPD is not only do they have emotional dysregulation, meaning they're emotionally vulnerable, But they have a double whammy. That is, that they have a great inability to modulate emotions. So they really, when you think about it, have a true skills deficit. And that is, when they can't do something, we can't assume that they don't care, that they're not trying. I think there's a tendency for many to jump to that conclusion. And I guess I ask you, are you able to do calculus without being taught? If someone says, just do calculus, and you don't have any foundation in it, you can't do calculus. When we say, just regulate emotions, and you haven't had any training in it, and you have this emotional vulnerability and this skills deficit, how can you just regulate emotions? How can you just tolerate distress? How can you just be effective interpersonally? When we say, just do that, that becomes inadvertently, oftentimes, invalidating. So, you know, when I first learned this, and I know Perry was also one of my first teachers of DBT many years ago, and we talked about this invalidating environment, and it was hard to imagine explaining this to families. And at first I was somewhat shy and cautious about it, but I realized it's not a judgment, it's a description, that despite sometimes our best efforts, we may negate or punish or ignore or dismiss an adolescent's behavior independent of the actual validity of the behavior, right? So if we say, just do this, and they say, I can't, you know, yes, you can. No, I can't. Well, that the valid truth of it is they're not able to yet without help, and they probably would like to do it if they could. So there's various kinds of invalidating responses, you know, where we dismiss or disregard or criticize or punish, or we sometimes pathologize normative responses. We sometimes ignore low-level responses and just attend to high-level responses. And so let me give you some other characteristics. So, for example, I think one of the characteristics of an invalidating environment where we might just indiscriminately reject the individual's self-generated behaviors. And again, sometimes it's despite our most well-intentioned efforts, we invalidate. So you might say to your teenager, you don't need to be so upset. It's such a small part of your grade when a kid is upset about a low grade. You know, what's the big deal? It's just a small part of your grade. You get class participation and so on. So that, right? So that's just indiscriminately rejecting. Or another example where we might punish emotional displays and intermittently reinforce emotional escalation. So we disregard the low-level communication. I'm guilty of this with my own kids sometimes. And imagine the teenager says, you know what, school sucks. My teacher's so annoying, and so on, right? And then it kind of escalates, and the parent or the caretaker is not attending to that lower-level communication. And then the teenager says, you know what, I'm not going to school tomorrow. I'm not dealing with this. And then the parent says, well, you have to go. You know, you're going to get further behind. And the kid escalates. I hate this. I can't deal with this. I'm quitting school. And then the parent then says, well, what can I do to help you with your work? Right? So it goes from kind of not attending to it to now I'm going to do your work. I'm going to help you with your work. Let's get this done. And it doesn't sound so problematic, but if this happens over and over again, we might inadvertently reinforce emotional escalation. And so the key here is to listen and try to validate lower levels of communication to avoid reinforcing emotional escalation, right? So when the teenager says, school sucks, my teacher's so annoying, so tell me how your teacher's so annoying, what's going on, and kind of hit it early. Easier said than done in our busy lives, multiple children. I'm not saying this is a piece of cake, but it is something we can kind of try to look for. And another characteristic of an invalidating environment is that we might oversimplify the ease of problem solving and meeting goals. You know, so a teenager says, I can't deal with this test. I'm so upset about it. You know, the parent, again, might say, don't worry, you'll ace it next time. No, no sweat. Again, we've all said that. Have I said that? Of course. But if the teenager who feels that there's no way to get better and really struggling hears someone say, don't worry, you'll ace it next time, it makes it seem like it's not a big deal. I should be able to do it. Just do it next time. Well, I don't feel like I can do it next time. So we have to be careful not to overestimate the ease of problem solving. Now, one other point I want to make about this is that for many of the families I work with, it's honestly very difficult when you have a teen who is highly sensitive, highly reactive, and variable, and emotionally labile, where you don't know what mood you're going to catch them in. And so it's very easy, I think, to be walking on eggshells sometimes, kind of not knowing what to expect. So I think the key thing that I've learned over these last 17 years is, in terms of the biosocial theory and teaching the biosocial theory to parents and to teachers and to coaches and to other therapists and to medical doctors, many of whom only have 5 minutes with their patients, is that the value of validation cannot be overstated. And when you're validating, you really want to not be withholding, and you really want to linger on it. You know, that I understand that you're feeling so sad that you didn't get invited to the prom. That has to hurt so much, you know, for example. And I think therapists sometimes get afraid of spending too much time and on this idea of validating these negative emotions. And I think some of it is that therapists are truly uncomfortable with swimming in the sad or negative affect pool. And I think some therapists and maybe family members alike are afraid that they're not going to be able to get their teenager out of that negative emotional state. So as a result, I think there's therapists, and I know in the past, in hindsight, I've realized this, I might not have kind of leaned in, so to speak, metaphorically, with a greater dosage of validation of the individual's emotional pain. And again, in our multitasking, so to speak, busy lifestyle, it takes some extra time and devotion to do this. But it's so important, and I think it's so important for all of us to do this with the teenagers, and I think it's important to do it with each other, for parents to validate each other in their plight, and I think for therapists, we do this on a weekly basis in our therapist consultation team, where we validate how challenging it is. And I think for families, you know, over the years I've realized we've needed to give families some additional support too. And so in addition to the skills group and the family sessions, we often give parents some additional parent training, parent support. And certainly, Perry Hoffman and any ABPD have their Family Connections program, which is intended to address this as well. In our adolescent DBT model, there's weekly individual therapy, there's a weekly multiple family skills training group to teach all these skills. We offer telephone coaching to the teen and the family members so that they can get coaching 24/7 whenever needed to apply those life skills in real time. We offer family sessions on an as-needed basis, and certainly I think there's plenty of need to help the teen and family kind of work on communication and validation and problem solving. And then there's our weekly therapist consultation meetings to provide therapy for the therapist, so to speak. And our standard, you know, there's different lengths of adolescent DBT treatments, but it's typically the first phase of treatment is about 20 weeks long as we've developed it. And then we ask the teenager to join our graduate group, which I think is a necessary part of the treatment to help them strengthen and generalize the skills that they've learned in the first part of treatment. Now, I know I'm gonna break in a minute or two. I just want to make a couple of other points because a lot of folks in the community try to refer clients to me and say, you know, I like to do the therapy and I'd like you to do the DBT, Alec. And I say, do the DBT? And they say, yeah, well, you do the DBT and I'll do the therapy. And I guess there's a misconception in the field that somehow DBT is not a therapy, but it is kind of just a skills group. And I need to explain to the folks in the community that DBT is a comprehensive treatment and that that DBT requires each patient to have one and only one primary therapist. And from a DBT standpoint, for those who have borderline personality disorder, I think it seems that the comprehensive treatment, having an individual DBT therapist, seems to be necessary. I think there's more research that needs to be done. But I still feel that I'm sticking with the data that there will be an individual therapist, DBT therapist, there'll be the skills group, and they'll work on the same team. And I think it gets very murky. Who's going to do the coaching, if there is coaching after hours, and who's going to reinforce the skills learned in group if you're not a DBT therapist? So I'd ask the community therapist if they really think they need DBT to take a vacation for a certain number of weeks, and then I'll send them back afterwards if they're so inclined. So to sum up, I think in future directions, I think that we need to do more research that's extending this to other settings and populations, DBT that is. And I'm very interested, and I've started to do DBT in elementary, middle schools, and high schools, and I'm interested in prevention. And I'm interested in prevention of various kinds, not just tertiary prevention, that means the kids already have BPD, but I'd like to do teaching skills to youth who are secondarily at risk, you know, showing at-risk symptoms but not full-fledged BPD, and maybe catching it early. And I know NEA BPD and CBCW, Cognitive Behavioral Consultants of Westchester, where my group practice in White Plains, and other organizations are very interested in helping teens and families with BPD. And as Perry said, on March 9th, where Perry Hoffman and Blaise Aguirre and I are hosting a full-day conference that addresses this topic in much more depth, and I want to encourage people to register on the NEA BPD website. And I want to thank Perry Hoffman again for inviting me tonight. And I welcome some questions.
Oh, Alex, thank you so much. Well, I'm going to just start out with a few questions for you. Is there any way that you can just write up a reference sheet for us for all the wonderful articles that you quoted?
I'd be happy to.
Okay, and then we'll post that along with your presentation. Also,
sure.
To save me getting inundated with emails, will you let people know how they can contact you directly?
Because
you do have a private practice or an agency. Could you let
people
know how to do that?
Sure. My email at my group practice called Cognitive and Behavioral Consultants of Westchester is amiller@ cognitivebehavioralconsultants.com.
And I will also say that you have a long waiting list, but you have wonderful colleagues working with you as well, right?
This is true. Well, thank you. Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to jump into this question right away because it really makes me happy. As a pediatrician who used to see 40 patients a day in my primary care practice, I often felt completely unprepared and unable to screen for and cope with emotional distress in my teen patients. What advice would you give to pediatricians to increase their ability to screen for and intervene with emotionally dysregulated and multi-problem, quote, at-risk youth?
No, it's a great question. You know, I think I've encouraged a lot of doctors who with busy practices. First of all, there's no shame in using a few self-report measures. And there's Kim Gratz, who I referenced earlier in this talk, developed a brief questionnaire called the Difficulties with Emotion Regulation Scale, DERS, D-E-R-S. And that's, I think you can get that online for free, I believe. But I think to certainly ask teens about directly and just matter-of-factly, and I think it is hard in a very busy practice, but to ask in terms of how are they doing with managing their emotions in their stressful lives, and look for any opportunity to validate how stressful it is to be a teenager in this day and age. And I think just leaning in and with a pregnant pause and saying, I know, you know, being a teenager in the 21st century is not easy. We can almost assume that would be true of anybody walking into your office. And how are you coping with it? And are there times where you have trouble coping? And if so, what does that look like? What do you end up doing? And I think that might just lay the foundation for a brief, but I think pointed and relevant discussion.
Okay. Do you see teens with BPD that don't show any self-injury symptoms?
Yes. I think there's definitely a misconception that it's only adolescents who self-harm or are suicidal have BPD, but there's so many permutations of individuals who have BPD. Because there are 9 criteria and you only need 5 out of 9 to be diagnosed with the disorder, one of the criteria is suicidality or self-injury, and the others obviously are not. So, yes, I see plenty of youth who don't have that criterion.
Okay. Does a psychiatrist ever avoid telling his patient they're borderline? Is it for legal reasons, insurance reasons, or fear the person will not stay in treatment?
I think it can be any and all of those, as well as the ones I mentioned earlier, worried about the stigma, worried about reimbursement from an insurance company, worried that they don't know how to treat that. So how can I tell someone they have that if I don't know how to treat it? So this, again, I really want to encourage practitioners to have a frank discussion, but you have to assess for it. You have to actually make a diagnostic assessment to see if it's present, and if it is, I want to ask people to avoid avoiding.
Okay, and here, how do you differentiate an adolescent that has oppositional defiant disorder, comorbid ADHD, or other diagnoses that emerge in adolescence?
Yeah, well, you know, in all fairness, it's not an easy, it's not easy. And I think, you know, the key piece here is you want to look in terms of the emotional shifts. And while oppositional defiant and ADHD kids certainly can be, ADHD can certainly show impulsivity and inattention and sometimes some emotionality associated with it. It usually doesn't have the intensity of the emotional swings that you would see in borderline adolescence. So there's usually more rapid shifting, in one moment feeling okay, the next moment feeling sad and even tearful. So there, adolescents with BPD tend to be on the ends of the emotional spectrum. So for some, for some average teenager, they might feel a little blue. An adolescent with BPD might feel much more profound sadness and weepiness, not just a little bit butterflies and giving a public speech, but maybe having a full-blown panic. So whatever the emotion is, teens with BPD feel it much more profoundly and display it much more evidently. ODD, oppositional defiant, I really think is a garbage pail diagnosis for kids who are defiant. And while adolescents with BPD may be defiant, they have a lot of other problematic behaviors associated with it.
Okay, Alex, thank you so much. This was absolutely outstanding. I will forward you the emails that say terrific, bravo, fantastic. So thank you so much. Thank you for taking your time to do this. We'll look forward for your reference sheet, and actually someone else had the great idea to add your email to it as well. So
yes.
If people want to make appointments with you, they can do that.
I certainly will. Perry, thank you again. Thanks to NEA BPD, and thanks to you all this evening for your time.
And our next week's call will be with Dr. Sherry Manning. Loving Someone with Borderline Personality Disorder is her book. And if you want to hear more from Dr. Miller, please join us at the March 9th conference in White Plains. Thanks, everybody, for being on the call. Have
thanks,
a good
Perry.
Night.
Good night. Bye.